All right, welcome everyone. You're going to love this interview we have for you today. David Morgan from themorganreport.com. David Morgan is an extraordinary individual. He has been covering precious metals, especially silver, for quite some time, and he is an analyst, just top of the world analyst at looking at the trends and understanding what's happening, but also teaching you how to not lose your shirt in metals investing, which is easy to do if you're over leveraged. So David Morgan, welcome to the show, sir. It's always an honor to be able to speak with you.
Well, Mike Adams, it's an honor to be with you, and it's a mutual admiration society, but we both have done a great deal of effort to try to bring the truth to people. Thank you for the introduction.
Absolutely. So let's just jump right into it. I want your assessment, first of all. Our topic today is about Western Europe and the, you know, I've been talking for days in the podcast about the imminent financial crisis, because we've got, of course, the gas shut off. Nord Stream 1 is at 0% flow. You've got massive debt instruments, derivatives tied to energy markets that are about to implode, the threat of government bailouts or even government takeovers of energy. You've got some people in countries like France paying 1,000% higher electricity bills. You got massive shutdowns of industry, steel factories, aluminum smelters. I mean, it's just across the board, pubs and restaurants and cafes. They're all shutting down. So, I mean, not maybe not all, but they're all those categories are having shutdowns. That's the more accurate statement. But what is your assessment, given that we're only in the first week in September, essentially? What is your assessment of where Western Europe is headed this winter?
Almost into the abyss. That's probably too strong an analogy, but very much blackouts, brownouts. There will be people that probably don't get enough heat to live. I hate to say it, but that's the way I see it. You ask me how I see it. If I could be so bold, Mike, to just digress a bit and give kind of an overlay on this whole thing so people really understand what we're talking about. Not that you're not very clear and concise. It's just there's a misconception. And the misconception is this. There was a docudrama done out of the United Kingdom many years ago, and I used to use it as my starter for many speeches I gave throughout Europe. And it was about an oil derivatives gone bad. And then they have up the Ministry of Finance from the UK. This is an imaginary scenario that's very much what's unfolding right now. And in this, he says that people think, I can't do a very good British accent, but he says, people think that the world runs on money and finance and that sort of thing, currency trading. But no, it runs on energy. Without energy, nothing happens. And energy means oil. And when I saw that docudrama, you know, it tweaked my situation. You know, I've kind of more or less thought finance, money, whatever, but really it's energy. And so that's what we're talking about. I wanted to bring that to the fore, Mike, because there are people who think, oh, if I got enough money or I got enough silver or whatever, I'm okay. You got to have enough energy. That's the bottom line.
Well, it's interesting that even Putin said just the other day that the West needs to dispel its illusions. This I'm paraphrasing, but its illusions of fictional economic activity based on financial instruments, and understand that real economic activity comes from energy and commodities. You know, things like minerals, aluminum, iron ore, coal, things like that. And you know, no matter what people think of Putin, I can't disagree with that statement. You know, you can't live on derivatives, right? You're going to have heat and water at some point, right?
Absolutely. No, you just, added on to what I said. And it's absolutely essential for people to understand this. What you really want to think of is the petrodollar with the petro behind it. Not much anymore. Things have changed drastically in the last several months. The point is that it was a unit of account for some amount of energy. And you're losing energy. So we can always think about it as debasing the currency and why gold should go up in paper price and all that. And it's all true. But if you really want to analyze it, let's say as objectively as possible, you want to think about how much BTUs, how much energy can you get out of that thing? And the answer is you can print them to high heaven, but it doesn't produce more coal, more oil, more uranium or anything else. And there's an energy equation that very few talk about. It's energy return on energy invested. If you want to go all green, and you're gonna dig up more of the earth than we ever had in regular mining. If you got to get out all these battery metals, it's gonna be like tenfold what we've already done on the planet. So anyone that thinks that they want an EV to save the planet better rethink it. It's just not going to happen. But back to your point, we are seeing the problem with complex systems, which means that all these banks are inextricably connected to each other. So you could have a bank in Chicago that may have energy derivatives exposure to something in Germany. And when it goes down, it starts taking down the Chicago bank. But yeah, but I'm in Chicago. They're all inextricably connected to each other. Now, I'm not talking about your country banks, maybe out in rural Montana, where they're loaning, you know, on land and, you know, farm equipment. That's a different story. But there aren't too many of those banks. Most of the big money center banks are full of toxic waste.
Yeah. Wow. Now, speaking of toxic waste, let's talk about toxic debt, because there is the chief executive officer of, let's see, GNS Economics in Helsinki, Finland, a man named Tuomas Malinen, came out with some tweets today that are just really bombshell. Let me just brief the listeners on this. This is a mainstream finance guy. He's coming out. He's an associate professor of economics at the University of Helsinki. He's coming out and saying that essentially Europe is on the brink of collapse. Those are his actual words. On the brink of collapse of our economies. He's urging people to have cash and firewood and food and water. I mean, he sounds like my prepping channel all of a sudden. And then he's saying that it's only a matter of time before the markets catch up to the deterioration of the economy that is already happening. He says, quote, we still have a few weeks, months at maximum before, quote, mayhem truly begins. Now, you know, David, you interact with a lot of finance people, and frankly, finance people don't normally talk like this. It's very unusual, is it not?
Oh, absolutely. And just to go from a 30,000 foot view, if you look at some of the best forecasters from the big picture, looking out, let's say 20 years ago, and I give credit, I can't remember who it was, I read so much and my memory's not perfect, but their thesis was that the final collapse on the global system, world system, will start in Germany, move to Japan, and then it's over. And you know, this looks pretty spot on from the way I sit and see it tonight. And have been. I mean, what's happened? What do we hear the most about on the energy side? We hear about Russia and Germany, Russia and Germany, Russia and Germany. And then what do we hear on the finance side? Japan, 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 Japan. Now, I'm not saying that's totally true, but it certainly fits. And the point, again, to reemphasize is that markets go up, can go up rapidly in a bull market, but they come down much faster than they go up. And you got to think of it as a domino falling and hitting another domino, except it's not linear. It's not one domino hitting one more and one more and one more. It's an exponential function. It's one domino, one bank goes down, it takes down two, and those two take down four, and those four take down eight, 16, 32, 64, 128. And that's what's the biggest problem, Mike. Well, these are exponential situations on the downside. The leverage is so extreme that it's not going to take much for this to collapse. And we're at tenfold, as you said, in France. I mean, a 50% move is probably enough to deleverage the system. And now we're talking, you know, 20 times that amount. I mean, this is insane and it's very, very scary.
To that point, there was another economist, and I regret who said this just the other day, but they were talking about how a couple of $1 trillion of economic output in Germany and Western Europe is dependent on just a few tens of billions of dollars in energy. So the leverage, he said, is 100 to 1, and Western Europe has reached a Minsky moment of massive over-leveraging, where the energy scarcity is now extreme. You know, again, backlash again because of the economic sanctions put on Russia. And by the way, I always laugh when the White House says that Russia is weaponizing energy, without mentioning the West weaponized the SWIFT system first, right?
Yeah, but really, I mean, the truth of the matter is, and I know you're a free market thinker like me, and you know, I know you don't cut your guests off. The real problem was we didn't keep our word. And if we had been so stupid as to cut off the and weaponize the dollar, their reserves that were valid, and say they're now invalid because we say so, if that had never taken place, then they at least could meet the debt obligations that they had the cash to do, but weren't allowed to do, it would be a different scene that we're talking about tonight.
Right.
But I'd say, yeah, go ahead.
Well, I'm just thinking, I think the West essentially stole about, what, $300 billion from Russia in terms of dollar deposits that were nullified, as you just said. But the cost for that to the West is going to be trillions of dollars in the economic losses. And that's not a good deal.
No, well said and very accurate. I mean, it's probably the most stupid thing that's happened in the world from any perspective, but we could say from a financial or energy perspective, that has ever taken place.
Well, let me mention this. I was get your comments on this. I know somebody, a family living in Kiev right now, and we were having a conversation about this. I said, "Look, how are you going to stay warm this winter in Kiev?" He said, "No problem. You know, Ukraine was never as quote developed as the first world cities like Berlin and Paris and so on. So, pretty much everybody in Ukraine has a family member with a kind of a low tech housing situation, like a farming." Village or hut, and they've got, you know, wood stoves or fireplaces built into the homes. That's where they're going to go. They're going to go stay warm. And I was telling him, if I were in Europe right now, I would almost rather be living in Kiev in a village taking artillery but having heat than living in Berlin and freezing to death. You see what I'm saying?
I agree. I'd say you'd be far better off in Eastern Europe than Western Europe. And, you know, he brought to mind, and I'm digressing, but, you know, going to Mongolia, which is quite an experience in all these yurts. But, you know, these rural lifestyles are a lot more adapted to these kind of variables than someone that's sitting in a penthouse in New York City somewhere.
Yeah, exactly. But it also seems like the people living in the cities, and certainly the, quote, leaders of Western European countries, are so isolated from reality that they think that they can just print money to pay people's electricity bills and everything's going to be okay. But as you mentioned earlier, you can't print heat or energy or food or fertilizer or urea or ammonia for that matter. You can't print that stuff. Those are real things. So, but the disconnect is so extreme. It's like European leaders are incapable of grasping reality anymore.
I agree. They're in their own echo chamber bubble. They aren't in touch with reality. I mean, some are, a few, maybe the Congress critters or whatever, but the total truth is that no. And they also believe they have power. And in some instances, I suppose we could agree, you know, they can sign their executive orders and they can make their speeches and all that. But at the end of the day, they don't have as much power as they think they do, because people will go to a survival mode. And when they're running out of food, water, heat, transportation, communication, you name it. I mean, I want to bring up a couple more points, Mike.
And please, that please is,
blackouts, brownouts. I mean, what happens when this energy problem manifests, say, further on a month or two from now, when we start to get into late fall, early winter, and these people, well, they're not going to sit there and say, oh, geez, I should stay inside and be happy. I can get my temperature up to 50 degrees Fahrenheit. They're going to take to the streets. They're going to, as Gerald Celente says, when you have nothing to lose, you lose it. And that's what's going to happen here. And no one's really talking about that. The article you reference is a great one of the Twitter feeds, I should say. But, you know, all of this, people just don't sit on their rear ends and take it. They stand up and go out and do something about it, even if that means getting to the banks and, you know, pounding the walls with their pots and pans. This is going to get very interesting, to put it in polite terms.
Well, I have a feeling we're going to see something of a repeat of the Canadian government's response to the Freedom Convoy truckers, basically calling all protesters terrorists, shutting off their bank accounts, shutting down their businesses. The governments of the world now look at their people as enemies of the state, even as they're trying, at least in my opinion, they're actually trying to starve people to death. I think a lot of this is engineered. That's just my opinion. But even if it's not engineered, going back to this economist named Malinin, he says, quote, "We are essentially on the brink of another banking crisis, comma, a collapse of our industrial base," which we've confirmed, I'll talk about that, "and households, and thus on the brink of the collapse of our economies." Now, he's right. You know, we just documented yesterday, David, all the steel plants that are shutting down. You know, the smelting operations, aluminum, copper, zinc, manganese, that's on top of the banking crisis that he's talking about. And by the way, if free markets don't function in energy, doesn't that essentially mean that the governments of European countries are going to, in effect, nationalize utility companies and just take them over? And then, of course, everything gets worse.
Yeah, that's the normal reaction. They'll try to mitigate the problem by thinking they know what to do. What politician ever, you know, ran a coal burning plant?
Right. They will have no clue what to do.
Absolutely none. I want to segue into the bail-ins on what you just mentioned, because people are not aware of how much there has been. You call it orchestrated, I'll call it engineered, but at least it's outlaw. And that is Dodd-Frank in like 2010 made bail out illegal. Now we have bail-ins in the United States, which means if the banks start to fail, they have the right to take what you think is your money, but it's actually, as an unsecured creditor, they will take your money. Now, if you look at Investopedia, they're going to tell you in their dissertation about bail-ins that you're safe to $250,000, what is the protected FDIC amount. That may be true, but I want to think about this deeper, and here's why. They could say, okay, your $250,000 is protected, but it'll be an Argentina situation. That part of your money, quote unquote, is still in our bank, but you can only access it $2,000 per month.
Right.
And that's what took place in Argentina. Now, one step further is the old adage, the proof's in the pudding. Cyprus already was bailed. They got about 5 cents on the dollar. They did it in Spain. They got about 5 cents on the dollar. What happens is they take what you think is your money, and then they give you a stock certificate and place of it, because now as an unsecured creditor of the bank, you are now part owner of the bank. Here's the amount of shares that you own based on what your deposit used to be. And now you got to go to the free market and say, what's this thing worth? Well, so far it's been proven that it's worth about a nickel
right.
on a dollar. So you've lost like 95 cents for every dollar you had in the bank. So the reason I want to bring this to everyone's attention is it's not just United States, it's also in the United Kingdom and several parts of Europe. It's already taken place. We have proof of that. And this is where they have another way to put more pressure on the populace. So the only way out that I see that makes sense is to go to precious metals, take that fiat and turn it into real money. Now, you could go to the bank and say, I want my cash, and I'm okay with that. But try going to a bank in the U.S. I don't know Europe. I haven't been there for 2 years now. But in the U.S., if you go up to the window and you say, I want to withdraw, make up a big number like 5,000, which these days isn't that much, they're going to make you sign a form. They're going to ask you why you're taking it out. They're going to take a photograph in some cases, and they're going to treat you like a criminal to take out, quote unquote, your money.
They are. Yeah.
You wire, let's say you have 300,000 and you think that you're protected for 250. So you're going to get it down to that amount. You can wire 50,000 to a well-known online precious metals dealer and have that metal within probably a week. Now you've got something outside the banking system. The idea is to get real wealth outside the banking system. As you said earlier, and this is the main point of tonight's interview as far as I'm concerned, it's going to get down to preserving what you have, not how much gains you can make.
100%.
30-year-olds and under are all in this crypto conspiracy crap, which I want to end on if we can, and talk about where that's really going, which we've already done before, but I want to emphasize it one more time. So none of these people at 40 years and under, I should say none, very few have stock accounts. They've been cryptoized since 2009-10. So for the last 10, 12 years, it's like crypto, crypto, crypto. Well, this was really a way to adapt these people into thinking the only way you could do any financial transactions is with your phone. And this is a setup for CBDCs after the bail-ins. Am I making sense?
Uh-huh.
Because I'll tell you, I'm on fire. This is getting serious.
Well, let's talk about the bail-ins. I want people to understand that this, what you're talking about here, David, applies to the United States and Canada, Western countries, because even though I think this crisis unfolds first in Europe, but and this is why people are rushing into the dollar, out of the euro. I mean, look at the dynamics between the dollar and the euro exchanges, but it starts in Europe. But when Europe fails, that's America's largest trading partner.
Yeah.
Then America loses its exports to Europe, including energy exports, by the way, you know, LNG and so many other things that go to Europe and cross trade. And of course, you mentioned Japan. Japan is a financial nightmare right now. In many ways, is in worse shape than 1989, and may have a bigger, longer lasting crash than 89. By the way, at least that's my assessment. But China has its own major debt problems. It is the Ponzi schemes of the property developers are collapsing. Many of the banks there are telling people you can't take your money out because we're doing software upgrades for 60 days, which is just a cover story. But eventually, America, even though America may be the last boat to go down, doesn't America take the hit as well?
Yeah, absolutely. As we talked earlier, the banks are inextricably connected. As I said, you get a Chicago bank that has, you know, energy derivatives with Germany, and that's a big part of their portfolio. Zing, it's affecting that bank. And of course, that's pervasive throughout the major money center banks. So you're right. These banks are all connected, and at least the money center top tier, too big to fail banks are all connected. And so if one goes down, they basically all go down. Now, you know, when it happened in 2008, that was kind of a precursor for what's happening next. And again, this gentleman that you referred to on the Twitter feeds is right. I can't find where he's wrong. Could I be off slightly? Sure. It's, and I hope I am, but I know markets, and I know once these things start to fall off the wall, Humpty Dumpty is not put back together again. And he's teetering on there right now, and I think he's going to be falling within the next month or two, as this gentleman outlines. There's too many things wrong that you outlined at the beginning. You can't have a tenfold increase in something as vital as energy, because energy is what makes everything happen, as we've discussed. So we are in a situation where you need to prepare yesterday. I'm not trying to play the fear card. I'm not that kind of human. You know me, and most of my listeners know me. But there is a time when you've got to amp up the message. And I want to amp it up tonight with you on your channel, because it's important for people to understand to prioritize what's valuable. And what's valuable is what they need for immediate needs, not what their wants are, or what their stock's going to do, or what crypto's going to do in the next couple of months, or anything along those lines. You've got to really assess what's happening and not be blinded to the idea that the powers that be know what the heck they're doing, because they don't have a clue.
No, they don't have a clue. I'm wondering what future historians are going to write about this when the story is that Vladimir Putin destroyed NATO by simply turning off the gas. and then nature did the rest. I mean, the freezing cold winter did the rest. It's like, wow. I mean, I see the destruction coming for Germany as being far worse than even World War II, which was just devastating to most German cities. But World War II was also devastating to France and the UK and Poland and so on. But at least in World War II, people still had a way to burn some wood and create some heat. There were still farmers who knew how to grow food, a lot of farmers. Today, you actually have a far more vulnerable population with fewer options of resiliency. The system has been built like this infrastructural Ponzi scheme pyramid, where there's no resiliency, no redundancy. They exported all the fossil fuels, or most of them, most of the delivery to Russia and other countries, and said, we're all going to be green. And now they're all going to be, you know, starving and freezing. It's just, it's extraordinary. Do you have a comment on that? If not, I've got a different question.
Only to reiterate a little bit, and that is that, you know, a lot of people say it's for real. A lot of people hold on till the last minute because of normalcy bias. Oh, it's going to work out. Yeah, I know the banks look like they're going to fail, but really they probably won't. And they get this idea that it's going to be okay if they just hold on. And then the reality sets in. And then what happens? Well, they've got a choice. If you've got to figure out how to, you know, burn all the books in your bookshelves and stay warm for a week, or leave. So what will happen is that a great majority of them will decide to migrate somewhere, anywhere. But that's going to be how? With energy. I mean, you can only drive your diesel-powered automobile so far. And maybe if diesel is in short supply, it only goes to the next, you know, few hundred miles, whatever the range is of your particular vehicle. What about flying? Okay, the airports are jammed and you get out. But what I'm saying is it's going to be a mess. It'll be an attempt to get out. And as the old adage goes, when there's a real fire in the theater and there's two exits, there's a lot of people that don't get out in time. That's my analogy.
I wonder if we're going to have a mass exodus of Europeans fleeing to central, to the Middle East and Africa. And then you've got the Middle Easterns migrating into Europe. So they can just pass each other on the way and high five each other. And the Europeans are like, don't go where we came from. There's no heat and no food. You know, it's right. Incredible.
Yeah.
Okay. Let me ask you about the morganreport.com, your website. Just give you a chance to explain to our listeners what it is that you offer at your website. What can they sign up for? Newsletter and videos and so on.
Thank you, Mike. Yeah, the main site, themorganreport.com, just get on our free email. You know, I'm shadow banned and have been for years. Yes, I'm still on YouTube and been warned a few times. I may be on there a lot longer. I don't. But if you're on a mailing list, I could contact you directly. I do a lot of free information. So watch our blog. There's usually two or three new things on there. The mailing list, I put up stuff three, four times a week. Sometimes I get the discounts on precious metals. Sometimes opportunities that aren't available anywhere else. I'm not going to say that happens often, but it does happen. And then the other part is my paid service. And that's where you get to interface with me directly. I write a monthly report and I supplement that with videos in between. And usually we take questions from our membership and I answer them by video. And I got a few really interesting ones this last couple of weeks. I went through them all, but one of them had to do with what was Volcker really the hero that he's made out to be. And I let people know in my membership that Volcker sold a great deal of this nation's silver at 92 cents when the official monetary price was $1.29. So he's no hero of mine, let me tell you. And the other fact I brought up, very few people know or think about, is that Nixon temporarily closed the gold window in August 15th, 1971. But on January 21st, 1980, the dollar price of gold was $850 an ounce. To a 100% monetary-based coverage of what a dollar is worth in gold was $400 an ounce. So we were at double what we would need to be on a full gold coin standard. So if anybody had any real cojones back then, we could have said, you know what, we're fixing the price of gold at 400, we've been on this temporary gold window closed for what would that be, 9 years. And now we're getting our financial house in order because the market has decided that we have mispriced the ratio between the amount of physical gold that we own in the treasury and what these pieces of paper are worth.
Right.
Start over, but no one ever talks about that. Well, but it brought it to the attention of my membership.
Let me ask you this, David, since time is running short here tonight, but silver right now, you know, a lot of people are a little bit depressed because silver prices are depressed. And, you know, especially given the insanity in the world, a lot of people are wondering why isn't silver higher right now? But again, it's, you know, you're talking about it being expressed in dollars and the dollars are going up because people are fleeing Europe into the dollar as a temporary thing. But what's your take on silver pricing, or you have any ideas where, when it might turn and head upwards?
I think by the end of the year, there's so many strong indicators, Mike, that there's a backwardation that's substantial. The lease rates are moving up at a rather substantial relative to the latest, you know, year or so. On top of that, silver has a propensity to get spiked lower so that the pros can get in there and take advantage of the public. So we might see a spike low, which has nothing to do with being basically a shortage right now based on lease rates and backwardation. So certainly it's a good time to get in and try not to pick a bottom, but certainly if you don't have any exposure, you need it. And we may have seen the bottom. I don't know. It's usually, as I said, and I'll repeat it, a propensity for the market to do what it did in March 2020 during the COVID scare, or initiation, I should say. And that was, we got this 125-to-1 ratio, but it only stayed there for a couple of days and then it started back up. So watch for a spike low. If you're smart enough to catch it, don't be scared. Go ahead and get in or start a position. And silver is the most essential asset there is outside of oil. We discussed mostly oil and energy this whole interview. Thank you, Mike. But the next important thing is a store of energy, and a store of energy is stored in silver. It's the most critical metal for a high-tech society that's ever existed. And it's the most undervalued asset you can own.
Even solar panels use a lot of silver. And there's a lot of silver components in the solar generators as well. David, let me ask you, just get a little closer to your mic there. Your voice was getting a little bit distant, but one more question to wrap this up about crypto. I want to make sure I give you a chance to talk about your analysis of crypto. And I know that John Perez And you have done some really amazing interviews, the crypto conspiracy and then some others. What's your quick take on crypto right now?
Well, as John said, and I tend to agree with him more and more as I get more data and think about it, is it's a psychological operation, at least partially. It was a ruse for people that would normally have gone into hard assets to go into this false paradigm called a cryptocurrency, believing that it had some of the qualities that gold and silver have. Anonymity, limited supply, and all these things that are touted. Turns out that that's just been a big falsehood. And a lot of people have been captivated by the idea of cryptocurrency and decentralized finance and all the attributes that are attributed to it, again, being falsified. And so now there's going to be a shift, as John says, when Bitcoin dies, silver flies. There'll be that wake up, like people trying to move out of Western Europe, people trying to move out of cryptocurrencies. And a lot of that will spill into the precious metals. As quick as I could go, Mike, I did the speech at the Silver Summit. I looked at the ratios. And based on what John Perez said on one of his interviews, the gold to crypto ratio isn't that impressive. In other words, the gold market's 11 trillion. The crypto market in total is 1 trillion. A third of that is Bitcoin. So gold, Bitcoin can't really move that much. Yes, it can move some, but silver, I mean, the amount of crypto versus the small amount of silver could have a massive effect. So when John talked about how many people got out of Bitcoin and moved into silver, it would have an effect. There's no doubt.
Yeah, well, a lot of smart folks did do that. They sold Bitcoin at 62,000 or close to that, and they bought silver, and they got cases and cases of 500 coins at a time. that was the smartest thing to do, is back up the pickup truck, load up silver, and get out of crypto. And people who did that are geniuses. But anyway, we're out of time here, David. I got to thank you. This has been extraordinary. You've given us a lot of fantastic information. Just want to remind people to visit your website, themorganreport.com. Any final words there, David?
No, I just want to thank you for all that you do, Mike. You got a lot of energy and you've done a lot for people. And I always think of you, how I first met you as the health ranger. And I sign off every report with wishing you health above wealth, wisdom beyond knowledge, because health is more important than any amount of money. So I want people to know that I know that.
Well, that's true. But silver helps you stay healthy, because being broke and cold and not having a roof over your head is bad for your health. So having assets is actually good for your longevity, it turns out. But thank you, David. I really appreciate you. And thank you for joining me at this late hour. We'll talk again soon.
Very good. Thank you.
All right.